HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 74, recorded Friday, July 13th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by Slash N Software Red Carpet Subscriptions, the most comprehensive solution for adding connectivity to your .NET and ASP.NET applications, with components for every major internet protocol. Online at www.nsoftware.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott and Carl talk with Jeff Atwood about building a new developer machine without breaking the budget.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin. You're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. I'm here with Scott and Scott's very special guest, Jeff Atwood. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, Jeff. Good to talk
Good
to you again.
Again.
Yeah. So what are we going to talk about, gentlemen?
Okay, so we did a show a couple of episodes ago about building the ultimate developer PC, and it went okay. But ultimately, the guy who's building the PC for me is Jeff, and Jeff is building it because he is deeply, obsessively passionate about stuff that I really don't care about.
Ah.
And he's got some really great posts that he's put up on his blog at codinghorror.com about the process of the building. He's just about finished up with those posts on the hardware side. I'll be taking them over and doing the software side. But what I thought we would do is we'd go through some of the comments of show 69 on building a developer PC, which some people said wasn't a particularly interesting show because the argument is that a gamer PC would make a perfectly good developer PC. So they're kind of arguing that the postulate was wrong from the beginning, that any fast machine is a good machine.
Okay. For developers.
For developers.
Well, do you think that's true, Jeff?
Well, I think there's some truth there. I think the point for me is that developers, it behooves you to understand some part of the hardware that you're working on. And that's the part that I really enjoy, is actually understanding, going a little bit deeper than the software and actually seeing how, you know, where are the bottlenecks in the hardware? Because a good developer will understand, you know, if you're hitting the disk a lot, the consequences of that, you know, when is the network the bottleneck? When is the CPU the bottleneck? And when you build the hardware, that's really what you do. You're playing a shell game of where is my bottleneck going to be and understanding that.
I think it's very much the same as audio recording. You know, the way you get a good recording starts with hardware, but too many people put emphasis on the hardware itself. A lot of it is, you know, mic placement and, you know, configuration of preamp gain levels and things like that. Good technique. So on a PC, I got to think that, okay, it's good to have your, you know, RAID mirroring and everything else, but if you're not configured correctly, or if you don't have the right drivers or the, you know, right enabling.
Well, but you just brought up an interesting point when you said mic positioning, because the first thing I thought about and actually was mentioned in the comments here on show 69 was that people don't take into consideration comfort. I know that's something that, Jeff, you're very passionate about, specifically the chair and three monitors.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the first thing I said to Scott, actually, was, you know, Scott, have you bought your three monitors yet? Because actually, the computer becomes, I don't want to say inconsequential, but not nearly as important as, you know, the things you touch, the things you see.
Right, your
those
interface.
Those are the things that are going to have the biggest impact on your daily computing experience. So that's right. We don't want to, you know, lose the forest or fail to see the forest for the trees, if you will.
So, no, I know. I read on your blog before that you have a specific kind of keyboard that you use that you've, like, bought them. They don't make them anymore, and you run around on eBay looking for this keyboard.
Yeah, that was the old Microsoft Natural Ergonomic Keyboard. Fortunately, they introduced a new model, I believe it's the Ergonomic 4000. It's a black keyboard. Because I personally like the Ergonomic, the split configuration. And then as a developer, the other thing about keyboards that drives me nuts, and actually there's developers at Vertigo that use these keyboards, and I'll never understand, is where they've moved the configuration of the arrow keys from the Tetris block shape, to like a diamond or something crazy. And similarly, insert, home, page up, that cluster will be rotated. This is to make the keyboard smaller, But as a developer, I mean, those are golden keys. You know,
yes.
I use those all the time. Those cannot move. So that is one of the things I look for, both to be ergonomically split, because I prefer that, and then that it's not what I call mangled, meaning that the arrow keys are in a traditional arrangement, and the home end page up block is conventional in arrangement.
Well, that's a good reminder to everybody to kind of rethink the keyboard. Are you using this particular keyboard that you're using now because it came with the machine, or because you've had it for years, or because it's truly a comfortable keyboard? I mean, if you're going to spend $2,000 on a computer, why not go and try out a bunch of keyboards and spend your $70 on a decent keyboard and mouse set? One of the mice that I use that I finally landed on is the Evoluent vertical mouse. Holds your hand in a handshake position, so it doesn't cause the bones of the forearm to twist over each other when you put your hand over the mouse, and that's made a huge difference in my hand pain.
I need a new mouse for that exact reason. One of the problems I find with mouse manufacturers is they try to improve a very simple device by, oh, here's the worst, the software that comes with the mouse. If anybody in my organization installs mouse software, they're fired. You know what I mean? Why are you installing that spyware? What is it that comes? Why does mouse need software?
You know, that's a really great point, and it actually reminds me of a blog entry that I want to write, which is, nobody hates software more than software developers. It is so true. I swear this is true. My wife was going to install the software that came with her digital camera, and I saw her doing it. It was almost like slow motion. I had to dive to get her to stop. I was like, no, don't install. You know, because it's just crapware. It's just going to mess up the PC. And sure enough, we have Vista at home, and she plugged it into Vista, recognized it automatically, pulled in the pictures. It was totally automatic.
Right.
You don't need any other additional software.
I also think the sensitivity level has gone high res enough. And in fact, I find myself turning it way down from what they suggest. You know, what that's a selling feature of
Jeff
mouse.
Jeff is not going to agree with that at all.
I really don't like highly sensitive mice.
Well, I think the adjustability is cool, and actually adjustability in hardware, this is another thing where it's actually better to have the feature in hardware because it's operating system independent, there's nothing to configure, et cetera, et cetera. I like mice's where you actually have the buttons that adjust the sensitivity, because what I'll do is when I'm editing, like I'll turn up the sensitivity and then turn it back down for normal browsing and so on.
That's a problem I have. See, I have a Razer mouse, you know those Razer mice? And you're probably like this mouse, but it's got like 7 buttons on the sides and stuff, and I'm always hitting them, and then, oop, the sensitivity just went up, and I end up dragging a really big file to the recycle bin by accident. So
which mouse do you have, Jeff? I know you have one with a hardware adjustable sensitivity.
This is a collaboration between Razer. Now, I have not historically been a fan of the Razer mice. They're too hardcore and, you know, just lowrider type mice. With like neon and all that stuff. It's just silly.
Yeah,
but,
I think so.
The Razer Habu is actually a collaboration between Microsoft and Razer, and it mimics the classic IntelliMouse shape, which a lot of people love and think it's like evolutionarily one of the best mice ever created with the IntelliMouse 3.0 shape. So it's sort of a mixture of both. It's got some sort of cool, you know, on-the-fly hardware adjustment features, but it's sort of a classic shape as well and doesn't have too many buttons. So I think there's a good blend of features you can find. And I think the lesson here is like Scott was saying, like, don't spend, you know, $2,000 on a computer and just use the trashy $10 keyboard that Dell gives you.
Right.
Like, think about these components that you touch every day and put some time and effort into finding ones that you really like, you know, and there's also ergonomic consequences as well. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I almost never have hand pain, but I know so many developers personally, like Phil Hack, John Galloway, and Scott have all had huge problems with hand pain.
Have either of you guys used the Data Hand or seen it?
I've seen it, but I just can't justify that kind of money.
Yeah, it is expensive. But, you know, if you're really trying to solve the problem, and, you know, I think that's a worthwhile thing. I use it, okay? So I have one and I practice with it, but I don't feel comfortable enough yet to just go out and replace my mouse and keyboard. And
send that to me, Carl. You should FedEx that to me and I'll use it for a couple of weeks and then do a review on it.
That's not a bad idea.
So let's talk about, we talked about keyboard, mice. These are all things developers touch every day. Now, when people saw the configuration of the system you're building for me, Jeff, they immediately thought we were building an SLI gaming machine because they saw that there were two video cards. And you kind of came in the middle of the comments and said, hey, folks, this is for multiple monitors, up to 4 different monitors. Why do you feel so strongly about the number 3 for your monitors?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is I think you can never have enough display space. You just can't. Like one of Tufte's point, Edward Tufte, the UI guy, is that displays are so low resolution. All you can really do is have a lot more of them, and you spend less time manipulating windows. I think I touched on this a little bit in the, my .NET Rocks show, and I still believe in that. It's like, it's basically stop overlapping windows. Overlapping windows does not help productivity.
Right.
So the reason one is unacceptable. You should have two minimum as a developer. That's part of the Bill of Rights, right? But I think three is even better if you can swing it. Now, I realize it is more complexity. At that point, you're dealing with two video cards. So I totally appreciate the difficulty in doing it. But if you're building your own rig, this is what it's about. It's about having things that developers need. And I think having a center monitor, so you don't have that like border directly in the middle of your, you know, display space, is huge. Because I can focus on the middle monitor and throw things, like in Minority Report, they just throw windows around. I'll throw the windows over to the side, then I'm like, oh, I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to come back to that. And I focus on the middle. So having a middle is a big deal. So it's really two things, just having a middle and just having as much display space as you can. I mean, sometimes I'll hear developers say, oh, why don't you just get a giant 30-inch monitor? I'm like, well, why not get two giant 30-inch monitors or three? I mean, it's not a zero-sum game where you have one giant monitor.
But do you really want to? You really want to have to spin around in your office chair just to check your email? You know, I mean, there comes
a
time where
I think what he's talking about is filling up 170, 160 degrees of your visual space.
Now the problem goes from your wrist to your neck. I mean,
but there's wasted peripheral vision there. I mean, the greatest monitor setup I've ever seen was the one that we did on that we talked about on the Monorail show when we talked to the guys from Illusion Software. Hmm. They've got a big 30-inch middle 16x9 monitor that's running like 2048 by something obscene.
Right.
And then they took two 22-inch 16x9s and turned them on their sides. And the width of them happened to be the exact height of the 30-inch monitor in the middle.
That's what Richard Campbell has. He's got a 30-inch and two 24s, I think, on both sides.
Now, Jeff, is my machine going to be able to run that kind of res?
Oh, absolutely. You should have no problem. But I think that's a brilliant configuration, and that's exactly the kind of insight I want to get. When you build your own PC, you have the flexibility of using three monitors, so like, use it, do it. This is what sets you apart. I mean, granted, it's not going to make you a genius programmer, but, you know, this is the whole point of going to all this effort,
right,
is to have these new and interesting options. And I love the config you described with one in the middle and the two on the sides rotated to match the height. The only thing you got to watch out for with rotation, and this is a subtle point, ClearType. Okay, so ClearType is you've changed the RGB orientation of the pixels. So all of a sudden, instead of 3x horizontal resolution, you have 3x vertical resolution. And to my knowledge, ClearType currently can't change its orientation. So you got to be a little careful there.
That's true. I have personally noticed that.
Well, when you say you got to be a little careful, isn't that a deal breaker?
No, it's not a deal breaker. It just depends on what you're using them for. I mean, if you're sitting close to them doing, if you're a designer doing work in Blend and you're spending a lot of time doing Silverlight and crispness and clarity truly matter. But if you're just using one monitor for SQL Enterprise Manager and one for Outlook and the middle monitor is where you live in Visual Studio, I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
I'd have to see it to pass judgment.
It's truly amazing. I may think about giving that. One thing though, I don't want to waste anything. I've already got a perfectly good 20-inch monitor. And a 22-inch 16x9, so I got to figure out what I can do to conserve those existing monitors.
There is a lot to be said for having matching sizes, because I'll tell you, at home I have matching sizes, and at work they're slightly different. And it is a little annoying, because things just sort of warp as they go from one monitor to the other, and it's
exactly.
A little disconcerting. It is nice to have alignment on your monitors. So,
well, specifically DPI alignment.
Yeah, I would almost say you can do that, but it's physically they have to have sort of the same DPI for the effect to really work.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's absolute for it to be optimum. It'll still be good, but if you want optimal, I would almost say sell those on eBay or just, you know, donate them but just get matching monitors. You will be happier in the end.
Well, certainly the wife acceptance factor won't allow me to do that. I need to be pretty specific about what I do with my money. But let's move on to the CPU, because one of the things that I said is I want this thing to be obscenely fast, but I want it to be as cheap as possible. And I think the whole thing has come in under, I think we were at $1,800 the last time we talked. And we're talking about a quad core here. And there's a gentleman in the comments of Show 69 named Abdu who comments a lot on my blog, and he always has a lot of really thoughtful comments, and he says, you know, what exactly is a developer's machine? Is it a machine that has VS 2005? I mean, everything else is fine. If I have fast memory and fast hard drives, I'm cool. He says, I'm not sure what a dual or quad core is going to buy you if XP and Visual Studio are not going to optimize themselves when they see more than one CPU. He says he doesn't believe that XP does well with parallel jobs. Is a quad core overkill for what I did?
I don't think so. In fact, I think as developers, we should be on the cutting edge in terms of multi-core future.
And utilizing
because if you
them.
If you predict sort of the future of where CPUs are going to go, you're not going to have one CPU running at 20 gigahertz. It's not going to happen. The physics don't work. what right. is going to happen is you're going to have a core running at, say, 4 gigahertz with like 64 different processors on it. So if nothing else, as a developer, you want to be experiencing this multi-core future and thinking about, hey, how do I make my app run faster without relying on the crutch of, oh, let's just increase the megahertz? You got to actually fundamentally code a different way. So I think it's valuable from on that level. And then on a practical level, I know a lot of people complain that Vista is slower, but Vista does a lot more stuff than XP. It's doing right. Windows Defender in the background. It's doing indexing. It's doing, you know, tons of, you know, UAC is going on in the background. It's doing a lot more stuff. I mean, it's, you know, a 5-year older operating system. You would expect it to do more. So since it's doing more, it's multitasking more. So if each little task has its own core, like if antivirus has its own core, you're going to have a better experience.
So do you think that this, I mean, what's the best way to utilize these other cores as an app developer? Does this mean that some little shareware application that I decide to download that's going to sit in the tray might start forking off other processes to do some works in order to get those processes running on different cores?
Right. So the way scheduling works, most modern operating systems are very good at scheduling tasks. They send tasks to an idle CPU. So if you have Word, Excel, Visual Studio, SQL Server running, and you have a 4-core machine, basically each one of those gets, in effect, kind of a private core to play on. It's really shared resource, but whoever's available will service requests. So there's 4 guys in the queue now waiting to service these requests.
Jeff, do you ever set the affinity on your processes when you run stuff?
I was just going to ask that. You nailed it, Carl. My first question was, like, do I have to tell Outlook to stay on Core 3, or is this going to happen for me?
This is what I call useless tweaking. Okay, so affinity, in certain very specific instances, can have effects, but for general purpose sort of applications that are doing a lot of, you know, just general purpose computing tests, there's really no value in micromanaging the CPU time like that. I mean,
Jeff,
you can, but that's what the operating system scheduler does, and it does a very good job at it. It's just not something you really need to think about.
I sure feel a lot better when I right-click on something in Task Manager and up it to high or above average priority, and it sure seems to make a difference to me.
Sometimes. But, Jeff, that's always been my thought, too, as, you know, the operating system scheduler is far better at keeping track of those things than you are in real time.
Yeah. Right. It's just like in writing in .NET, I would have people that were constantly like trying to outsmart the framework. It's like, let me think about what the framework is doing and let me, like, you know, manually garbage collect right now. And it's almost always a bad idea. And it's sort of the same avenue. You can do it. And there are specific instances where it actually will help, but they're really rare. So basically, just let the operating system do, you know, do its job and don't sweat the small stuff. But that said, and also priority is another one that can actually be very dangerous to play with. I have a whole blog post on sort of the danger of sort of manipulating priority. It's something developers love to do. Oh, I can create a new thread. Oh, wow, I can set the priority as a thread.
Right.
You know, and then they set it to like some extremely high priority and it locks up their machine. Or just, there's a lot of bad things that can happen if you micromanage this stuff. So,
all right, so that's a very excellent segue because one of the other comments on show 69 was by a gentleman named Matt, and he says, Carl is such a girl about overclocking. Now,
what,
Jeff,
what is that all about?
I think
what
that
did
on
I
that,
say
on that episode? You basically said you didn't think overclocking was worth the effort,
and then you basically
said what Jeff just said is don't micromanage this thing. Let it do its job. So kind of defend that against what you just said, Jeff. How is overclocking different?
Well, hold
than what
on. I feel
about?
I have to defend being called a girl about overclocking here first.
Well, it was said with a smiley face.
No, sure, if that helps. No, sure. I understand. Probably the reason that I don't worry about it is because I'm not a gamer, and I think probably overclocking is, you know, that's what the gamers do to get more. You know, I never had a need to overclock my PC.
But see, I wanted to overclock it because I told Jeff what my original price point was.
I see.
I think I said it was $4,000.
I now remember
and then,
the
and then I was told by my wife that it was not, in fact, $4,000. And I said, Jeff, how can I get another $1,000 out of this without actually spending another $1,000?
Okay.
Jeff?
Well, So let me first answer the criticism of this is micromanagement by first saying that it absolutely is micromanagement. The fact that we're building a PC, I mean, you could go to Dell and buy and have Dell do the work that we're going to do. So we've already committed to micromanaging at this point. We said, you know, look, the kind of control we need over the PC, we're going to micromanage this part of what we're going to do. So overclocking is a way of extracting more value out of that time. So just building a stock PC is, you know, it feels like even more of a waste of time, because at least if you build sort of a custom overclocked PC, you can say, look, you know, I built it myself, but look, this thing goes, you know, 20% faster than it would normally go. I saved $1,000 over the CPU that I would have paid for to get that speed, and I have everything exactly the way I want it. So by definition, we've entered sort of a position of micromanaging by design, because we want to. We enjoy it. We get something back out of it. So it's a reasonable criticism.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm on the verge of having my mind changed here by Jeff. Jeff, I don't know that much about overclocking, because I'm not a gamer, as I said, and I never felt that it was something that was necessary. But do you think it's safe? I mean, is it something that's safe to do? And if it is safe, why didn't they come overclocked in the first place?
Well, they do now from Dell.
There are some Dell systems that, in fact, are overclocked. They're very, very expensive, though. So those are exorbitantly expensive.
So they charge a premium to flip a bit in the BIOS?
Well, I think they set a premium to have an individual human being flip a bit in the BIOS and then burn it in for a day and do all the kind of stuff that Jeff's doing. You know, it's not every processor can be guaranteed overclocked. I mean, they have a certain personality to them. They are organic things, and you know, one might be overclockable and one might not. I mean, they're not always stable. And when you answer this question, Jeff, okay, talk to me about safety. I mean, one of the guys commented on my post about the building of this machine and how it was going to be overclocked, and he said he'd had trouble with a compiler spitting out bad code on an overclocked system.
Ooh.
Well, that'd be normal for you, right?
Nice.
I'm just kidding. So my philosophy here is, okay, it's kind of like the philosophy that I have towards code. And to me, there's a lot of parallels. There's a synergy between the software and the hardware. Not that I want to spend all my time messing around with hardware, but I think there's lessons there that apply to both sort of disciplines. And one of those lessons is it's kind of fun to break stuff. Like, it's fun to see the failure modes, because if I can see it fail, if I can understand the failure, if I can take it and break it and then fix it, I now understand what's actually happening, right? So some developers, if you gave them a PC and their PC started blue screening, they're like, what do I do? I'm completely hosed. My machine's blue screening. Whereas I would go, let's look at this machine. I understand why machines blue screen, because I've caused them to blue screen. Like, heat is a really common problem. So one of the first things I do is say, you know what, open the case, put a house fan blowing directly on it. Right. If it's still blue screens, then I can tell you it's not a heat problem, it's something else. And then start swapping parts out. So I've gone from being a guy who has to take my car to a really expensive mechanic because I don't know what to do, to a guy who can, like, change my own tires if, you know, I get a flat tire on the highway. And I think there's a lot of utility in having some of those skills. Not all of them, but enough to be conversant and enough to be, you know, if you get yourself into trouble, you can get yourself back out of trouble. So that's sort of my philosophy there, is I want to be able to break it so that I can understand it.
See, now you can see why I asked Jeff to build this for me.
Sure. I guess I'm just getting old, guys. You know, I used to have the energy to go after why my machine is blue screening. Now I just kick it, you know?
Well, what
right.
About,
totally valid position, too. I just want to emphasize that I'm not saying this is the correct right way, and if you're not doing it this way, you're not doing it the wholly approved way. It is totally valid to outsource this and say, look, you know what? I let Dell worry about that, you know?
Or somebody else, anyway.
There was a great, great comment on my blog, and I just want to read it to you. As an example from another field, I think it's similar to how you'll frequently see celebrity chefs on PBS go to a winery, an organic farm, or a bakery. They aren't going to learn something there that will make or break their ability to cook a specific dish, but as a master craftsman, they're passionate about their tools and ingredients. They want to know everything they can about them. And,
right.
And I think that's what it's about. It's like saying, hey, I'm so into this, I just want to do this, right? It doesn't make me better than you. It doesn't make me worse than you. It's just something that I personally find interesting. I enjoy that aspect of it, and I want to explore it. And it does kind of feedback in and sort of make you a better developer in some ways, I think.
You know, that's a very, very compelling argument. Sometimes people say that, like, if I go traveling, why do I bother learning the local language? I can just stay at the Holiday Inn. You know, it's the same kind of thing. It's not in any way making any kind of a qualitative value judgment about one person style versus another person style. You know, if you want to go to Africa and eat at Burger King, you know, the Burger Kings are there. I mean, they're there. I mean, you can stay in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe at the Holiday Inn and you can eat a Burger King and there's nothing wrong with that. That's just not how I roll and that's not how Jeff rolls.
No, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So hang on though. I didn't think we answered the question about is the overclock system going to be correct? How much have we overclocked our system from what?
Well, how do you know your code is correct? This is the whole philosophy of like unit testing. My torture test is a unit test on the hardware, right? I'm just sitting there running Prime 95, four instances, one for each core, for hours and hours and hours till I'm absolutely confident that
it's working. What's that? Is that a prime number generator that just keeps going or something? What is it?
Prime 95 is a prime number generator, but as one of the side effects, it turned out to be really hard on CPUs. So they actually added a menu item based on its popularity as a CPU sort of testing tool to do various kinds of torture tests. And it's cool because you can adjust the formula based on the size of the prime number you're calculating. It either loads like just the CPU, the level one, level two cache, or if you do a big enough one, it starts loading the memory as well because these things get too big to fit in the cache. It's a really great tool. I love it. And it exposes overclocking failures really rapidly, which is another reason people like it. Like you may think you're stable. You could like compile code all day long and use Internet Explorer or you know Firefox all day long. But the minute you fire up Prime 95, you're going to fail. And that's why we love it so much.
Very cool. So is there anything we missed?
Well, I think one last question we didn't cover that came up in all of the comments was about whether or not RAID, be it software or hardware, was important to the developer PC.
Ah. Well, before Jeff chimes in, I'll just say I think mirroring with hardware RAID a system drive is a necessity today. I wouldn't build any new machines that didn't have the system drive mirrored. I just don't want to worry about losing stuff. So,
right. And I'll follow on with Carl's statement by saying that is the one method of RAID that I think is absolutely safe and totally recommendable is if you want redundancy, mirroring is great because it's just a binary copy. So if at any point one drive fails, you just literally, you know, toss it and put the other one back in and you're back in business. There's nothing complicated to figure out about RAID mirroring. Now, on the downside of RAID, though, beyond mirroring, is there's all these different variants, like many, many different variants of RAID. Some are for performance, some are for redundancy, right. And some do both. But it's all complexity, right? So you're always balancing how complex do I want my system build to be versus how reliable and simple to work on and understandable do I want it to be. I've had a bad luck with a lot of motherboard RAID implementations where they tend to be very specific, very proprietary. And particularly RAID striping, which a lot of people do for performance where the reads are interleaved.
Dangerous.
It's very dangerous because it doubles your chance of drive failure. And on top of that, it doesn't really improve performance really enough to justify the risk.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
So my general recommendation with RAID is, you know, just be really careful with it. I would advise sort of shying away from it unless you have some really compelling need. Like you do video editing and you know that's the one thing you need. That's fine. So it's a question of like, where's your bottleneck, right? So when we're building this developer PC, we're building a PC free of major bottlenecks. But on a video editing PC, the disk might be more of a bottleneck than a developer PC. So that might be a rational argument at that point.
Absolutely.
So I would probably say, if I'm putting words in your mouth, Jeff, that a 10,000 RPM or a 15,000 RPM system drive would be a better investment.
Mirrored.
Than a mirrored drive. No, I think Jeff is, because I don't think the system we built is mirrored.
No, it's not mirrored. So,
well, if you're trying to save money, you probably don't want to buy two Raptors, you know?
Right. That's right. So it's, again, a question of why have two drives that when you could have one, right? That's the simplicity argument. So rather than two 7,200 RPM drives in, you know, striped mode for speed, just buy one Raptor and you'll get all the same benefits. This goes for video as well.
I think Scott was saying, why mirror, you know? And
yeah, my question is, should I buy another drive? Should I put another drive in the C there? Because it really comes down to ultimately how much your time is worth. What does a Raptor cost right now, 150 gig, 10,000 RPM Raptor, Jeff?
If your system drive blows up, is it worth the time that
right.
it's going to take to unscrew
that? With a RAID setup, what was that drive worth, Jeff? $200?
No, like 130.
Okay, so 130. So let's say that you're a consultant and you're paid 130 an hour. So you're doing your work, you're in the middle of something, and the last backup that you did was last night. So if you are running RAID and a drive dies, you keep working. If you're not running RAID
mirroring.
If you have mirroring and your drive dies, you're cool. If you don't, then you're going to lose more than an hour's time.
Definitely.
If you're a consultant and you're doing mission critical work, well, RAID mirroring won't guarantee you against a corrupt NTFS volume or a screwed up registry. If a drive goes down for want of $130, you may suffer.
Right. Well, everybody has different backup strategies. And again, I do like RAID mirroring. I think it's by far the safest kind of RAID and the most recommendable type of RAID.
Right.
But everybody has a lot of different backup strategies. And I know, Scott, you probably have obscene backup strategies. So you might decide, you know, as much as I'm backing up, it's, you know, just another piece that I have to add. It's completely up to you.
No, that's totally valid. For me, Folder Share and Subversion are my major backup strategies. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I've got my data spread across 5 different machines. And Folder Share backs them up within a few seconds of things changing, so I'm pretty comfortable. I've also got several offsite backups. So while I would still lose an hour because I'd have to reimage the whole system, I'd probably lose 4 hours. You know, basically, let's just say this. Let's be frank. You lose a system drive, you're down for the day, right?
Pretty much.
You have RAID.
Pretty much.
And
even if you do have RAID, you're still getting down your hands and knees on doing that drive, and you're going to lose maybe an hour, half an hour tops. Well, guys, I think we've set ourselves right. Don't you think, Scott?
I think so. I think we need to just come up with a title for this, this little podcast. Not the Hansel Minutes part, but the building a developer's PC, This Time We're Serious.
Yeah, I think that works for me. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
And tell us about this new machine, Scott, when you get it all up and running. We're anxious.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be obscenely fast.
Very cool. All righty. We'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes.